broadcasting from the UNMC College of Nursing. Get ready for RN Huddle, the podcast dedicated to bringing hot topics for and by nurses to the table.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to RN Huddle. This is your host, Heidi Keeler, and I'm joining you from the UNMC College of Nursing in Omaha, Nebraska. RN Huddle is pleased to once again partner with the National Pressure Injury Advisory Panel, often known as the NPIAP. Formed in 1986, the NPIAP is a professional organization dedicated to the prevention and management of pressure injuries. This group is comprised of leading experts from a variety of healthcare disciplines, making it incredibly interdisciplinary and one that nursing is always interested in hearing from. So this partnership will bring a series of episodes to you in which we'll explore a variety of pressure injury topics. And I am so thrilled and so excited to report to you that this series is created in collaboration with the College of Nursing's very own Dr. Joyce Black. Dr. Black is a prolific researcher on deep tissue injury, heel injury, and also dermatitis, and is internationally known for her work in pressure injury prevention and treatment. We'll be bringing you these episodes once a month for the remainder of 2024, and we definitely hope that you enjoy them as much as we're enjoying making them for you. We know that the NPIAP always brings amazing information, and it's definitely information that you can immediately put into practice as a nurse. So without delay, we are going to turn the mic over to Dr. Black. And Dr. Black, thank you so much for bringing your wisdom and your expertise to us today.
Thank you, Heidi. I'm Joyce Black. I am the current president of the National Pressure Injury Advisory Panel, or the NPIAP. I'm also a professor in the College of Nursing. And so I'm actually right down the hall from Heidi and the rest of the group as they work on continuing ed projects for around the nation centered here in Omaha. The purpose of the podcasts that you will have an opportunity to listen to are really to look at pressure injuries. What do we know about them? But particularly to unwind what we might think of as the fallacies, misguided thought on why we don't think they're preventable, or what do we do with people who are non-compliant and won't do what we say. So each month, I will moderate these pieces, hopefully taking only about 30 minutes of your time, with various guests, people who are part of NPIAP and other specialists from around the nation. The NPIAP website will actually be a place for you to explore, and you will find these podcasts there as well as within the University of Nebraska system. So I hope you enjoy them. If you have ideas for topics for podcasts, please feel free to contact me. I'm at the university. So my email is pretty simple. It's jblack@un for University of Nebraska. MC for medicalcenter.edu. I want to thank Courtney Smith for being the wizard behind the drape that makes all these things come together. And I look forward to having a chance to chat with you as we go forward. Welcome to the NPIAP podcasting program. We're going to explore pressure injuries, facts, and fallacies. And I think many of you know there's plenty on both sides of that coin. Our guest today is Kathleen Volman, a specialist in critical care. So I'm going to turn to Kathleen in about a minute and a half. I want to start with what's in my mailbox. So I got an email. I'll read you the email, and then I'll give you a chance to think about how would you answer this. I'll tell you how I answered it. So here's the email. If a patient has a closed resurface scar from a previous pressure injury, and now a deep tissue pressure injury develops in that same area, what is that? How do we label that? And so the writer goes on to say, Is that a new wound or is that a recurring wound on top of a previous injury? And if it's recurring, how do we stage it? We're seeing this more and more as people now survive complex hospital stays, such as Kathleen's going to talk about, and have a pressure injury that they go on to heal. Now, particularly if this pressure injury has been healed secondarily, so they had debridement, negative pressure, and now heal with scarring. We know that scar is only 80% as viable as the native tissue. But the real factor in this case is the time. When did this happen and where are we in time? Because we usually consider after a year that the tissue is fully healed. And in that case, this would be a new pressure injury. The staging of it, of course, is totally dependent on what it looks like. But the scarring when it ulcerates doesn't look like stage one and two. It looks like ulcerated scar. So it's likely at its early stages going to be a three or a four. So each of the podcasts will start with what's in Joyce's mailbox. Hopefully, it'll give you some things to talk about over break or over coffee. And now I want to turn to my guest today. I'm very, very thrilled to be able to introduce you to Kathleen Volman. Kathleen and I have known each other for many, many years. I consider her the consummate educator, instructor, facilitator of things related to critical care. Thank you for joining me, Kathleen. Please introduce yourself to the group.
Thanks, Joyce. Hi, everybody. I'm glad to be here. Just to give you a background, I've been a nurse for 44 years, pretty much critical care the entire time. Back then, we had to do about 6 months of med-surg to get started. I practiced 10 years directly at the bedside, mostly medical ICU, but did do trauma and CVICU and some neuro thrown in there. In 1989, I graduated with my master's as a clinical nurse specialist in critical care specifically, and started my first clinical nurse specialist job at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit, Michigan, in 1989, and I walked into a unit that had some significant challenges with pressure injuries and only one WOC at the time for a 650-bed hospital, which back then was normal. So I sort of assumed the concept of managing, treating pressure injuries, as well as learning significantly about prevention. And in 2003, I launched my own company, which is focused on creating empowered work environments for nurses through knowledge, skill, and process. It's called Advancing Nursing LLC. And I last year got elected to the board of the National Pressure Injury Advisory Panel. So I get to work with Joyce in that capacity, which I'm very excited about. And in October of this year, I was elected to become the president of the World Federation of Critical Care Nurses. So I've spoken on pressure injury topics related to critical care nationally and internationally, and have also published on it.
Kathleen, as you can see, was a phenomenal choice for NPIAP to add to our board, and here's why. Kathleen, the US and probably worldwide, pressure injury development in the critically ill has the reported highest incidence compared to any other location of healthcare. What do you think drives that rate? Why is it so high and stays so high?
Well, I think you're looking at patients with significant comorbidities. You're looking at risk factors of immobility, malnutrition, on a mechanical ventilator, on vasopressors. So perfusion and oxygenation issues contribute to it. And then for me, one of the biggest challenges I've had to overcome throughout my entire career is this concept that I can't turn the critically ill patient because they're hemodynamically unstable. And I will share with you that through my journey, because I did my thesis on prone positioning in the 80s, I had to defend how you could safely turn a critically ill patient 180 degrees upside down and how you could manage that. So I delved into the physiological science around it and came up with some strategies, stepwise strategies, to basically train a critically ill patient to tolerate turning. And so One of the biggest challenges I find is the immediate fear that the staff has when they turn a patient and they see the blood pressure go down or the SAT go down. And their immediate response is to put them back into the supine position.
So, Kathleen, I think you and I must have been standing in the same room when we turned a patient and WOM lost their, now didn't lose their pressures completely, but they fell precipitously and everybody got scared. And so that patient really wasn't turned after that because everybody around said, well, we're not doing that again because we don't want to take that patient's life just by turning them. So in those instances, how do we as experts in the area of pressure injury get over that bump? I don't want to do anything either that takes a patient's life, but I don't want to create a problem that they could die from, a pressure injury that leads to sepsis, because I didn't do the things I should have done. So you said it, the two big words I heard from you, and I want to unpack a little bit, is hemodynamic instability. I'd love for you to define it and tell us what we can do with it. And then the anxiety of the bedside provider. So can you tackle both of those?
Yeah, so for hemodynamic instability is basically when a patient has, it, depending on who you look at for the definition, it's usually a systolic blood pressure less than 90 or a mean arterial pressure of less than 65. And where somebody may have to treat that either with fluids or vasopressors. So it's basically showing circulatory challenges. You may also see a drop in saturation as a part of this sequela. And so what happens is the nurse sees that when they do an activity. So one of the things you have to think about is what activities did you do before that? When you're dealing with critically ill patients, they have a limited amount of oxygen supply to meet the demand we place on them. So their disease already places significant demand. They have a fever. Their breathing above the vent increases oxygen consumption. Our activities that we do, bathing, turning, all of that increases oxygen consumption. So if we do that all in a row, and then turn the patient so they can rest, we've resulted in almost 100% increase in their oxygen consumption. They don't have it. And that's where the instability comes in. So one of the steps you can do as a caregiver, as a nurse at the bedside, is space your activities with those severely critically ill patients.
So what you're talking about is something that we actually don't do very often, and that is space out stuff. We tend to bundle it together because of a shortage of time. We're trying to get all this stuff done. So what I've personally seen is what I call the heave-ho term, where I've got all these things done, and now I need 4, 5, 6 people to come in. They don't have all the time in the world, so I get everything ready, and then on the count of 3, 1, 2, and the patient comes over with this massive turn, and then the floor falls out. So what you're saying is break that up. What, turn them more gently, turn them more slowly?
Well, there's a couple of principles in there, Joyce, that, you know, as you said, unpack. That first one is spacing the activities so that they have enough oxygen available to manage the turn. That's one aspect. The other aspect is there is a physiological principle, and I've published on this, of gravitational equilibrium. And it comes from the aeronautical research world about what happens to the stretch receptors when they're trying to address different gravitational planes in order to get the astronaut up. It takes 9 Gs. If they started at 9 Gs, the astronaut's entire blood volume would be in their toes because the body couldn't adapt to that. The stretch receptors couldn't equilibrate to it. So they started a 0.5 G and they worked their way up.
You're really talking about perhaps not only spacing out meds and treatments, but spacing out some of the movement of the patient at the same time so that we're not doing the big heave-ho turn?
Yeah, so for example, one of the things is do the front of the bath. Walk away, give them 20 minutes, and come back and do the turn. The other thing is the speed of the turn, because the faster you turn them, the harder it is for the stretch receptors to equilibrate to that change in gravitational plane. So there's a couple of components that come into play here. One, if they hang in the same gravitational plane for a long period of time. So let's say they're in the ER, then they go to the CAT scan, then they go to the OR, and they've been flat this whole time. I can guarantee you the first time you try to turn them, they will be hemodynamically unstable because they've established this comfortable gravitational plane and we're now changing it. So on those patients, that's when you bring in the activities of incremental turning. So not just micro turns, but incremental, to where you start at a 10 degree, then you move to 15, then you move to 20. So you're basically training them to tolerate that shift. And the other big component that comes into this, Joyce, is when we are evaluating these patients, and this is both for dangling as well as lateral turning, you need 5 to 10 minutes to allow that patient to equilibrate to the position change.
Oh, so not going from flat on your back to standing up at the edge of the bed, huh?
They need that time before you make a decision that they tolerated or didn't tolerate it. So when a nurse says to me, my patient was hemodynamically unstable with turning, the first question I ask is, did you make that assessment immediately after the turn, or did you wait the 5 to 10 minutes?
What you're describing is me on Sunday afternoon when I'm sound asleep on the couch and the phone rings. And I sit up and I get dizzy. And so the way you're using the phrase hemodynamic instability, it sounds like it's a physiological change. The way I see it used is, holy cow, this is a serious problem. And what you're describing is that it is the natural response of the body to prolong position in one position and now moved suddenly.
When they go into motion, under the concept of mobility. You know, there is just straight hemodynamic instability that occurs even when you're not touching the patient.
Those are great concepts to explore, because I have students in critical care. And, you know, they're scared to death, not only to move the patient, but pull out some life-saving tube. Obviously, I don't let all that happen, but I love the idea of hemodynamic instability as a physiological process, not always a pathophysiological process. You're talking about it being normal, the astronauts having to adjust.
Well, and them getting trained to tolerate it. So I've built algorithms and published this concept of the 5 to 10 minutes, the balance of oxygen supply and demand through spacing activities, the incremental micro turning. And if none of those work, then lateral rotation and train them to turn.
Thank you for that. That's excellent. That's just excellent. It's a different framework for us in critical care to look at that, because we tend to be very task focused. We got to get this done, get this done, get this done. Let's get the patient turned. And then we're afraid. I think you told me once, just ignore the blood pressure monitor for a few minutes, give them the chance to recover. Of course, yeah. I looked at you like you were nuts, but I think you might have been right all along.
Well, when I speak on this, Joyce, one of the humor components to it is I say, you know, when you turn them, just take the sat monitor off during the turn. And I'm like, no, I'm only kidding. But close your eyes, turn around, do oral care, do something else to give that patient the opportunity to equilibrate to that position change.
That's such a good practical piece of advice. I thank you for that. So I'm going to change the focus just a bit and ask you, are there situations where risk is not mitigatable, where we this pressure injury is going to occur. We cannot adjust risk. So is there situations in the ICU? I hear about them a lot. You know, we did the best we could. The pressure injury happened anyway. There was nothing left to do. How many of those situations are there in your view?
I'll be honest with you. From my perspective, it's small. And a lot of what happens, because you look at where the pressure injuries occur, they occur on the sacrum and heels. So what does that tell me where the patient is hanging out? They're hanging out on their back. And so by hanging out on their back, you then have this concept of, were they too hemodynamically unstable for turning? Did they try it? Did they go through this physiological process to get the patient to adapt it? Or did they just assume?
Would the use of levofed be considered a contraindication to moving?
Absolutely not.
So I know that there are a number of people who say the evidence I have for, and I don't mean legal evidence, but just the presentation I have of the fact that this patient's pressure injury was not preventable is he was on levofed. And my response, you know, because I see this up on the unit. I moved people when they were on levofed. Did I do something wrong? Well, and so that is the equivalent today. They're on levofed, they can't be moved. You're disagreeing with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Being on vasopressors puts you in a category where you do absolutely need to go through those steps to get them to tolerate turning. But they can. And I had a 32 medical ICU bed, urban center. This was in the 90s. Back then, about 85% of those patients were ventilated. Other than a patient cardiac arresting, I did not have a single patient hemodynamically unstable with turning, because if they were, they got a rotational bed and we trained them to turn.
No, that's excellent. So your work, your collective work, and I greatly appreciate the work that you do because I know you do it around the world. Your work has been focused, at least in the pressure injury arena, on how to reduce the risk of pressure injuries. How do you do that? How do you help nurses who are in critical care to learn what you just taught us? How do you approach them?
Well, when I'm rounding, when I have the opportunity to round, we actually go through the process so that they can physically see it, which that aesthetic, that visual, the kinesthetic components of learning, it tends to stick with them. I've also done journal clubs where we've actually reviewed the article and talked about the fears and the challenges. And I've done that remotely, which was a lot of fun. Presentations. People email me and ask, you know you know about this. Do you have anything that can help us? So I spread it that way as well. I've been on this bandwagon for a very, very, very long time.
Yeah. And so obviously you have figured out an approach for the new graduate working in the ICU all the way up to the nurse who's going to retire next month and has worked in the ICU for 40 plus years. Different approach for those two? Because I know that some of the listeners are wound ostomy continence nurses, and they are assigned to the ICU, and they walk in and they get this very strong nonverbal of, I'm here and I know what I'm doing. I've done this for decades. How can you tell me how to do it differently? They probably don't give you that same look. Obviously, you come in wearing the hat of an expert. How do you do that? How do you get over that bump?
So that's a great question, Joyce, because I've been asked by WOCs and I've presented to them so that they would understand the science. Because if they come at it from the evidence perspective to that experienced or young clinician, you're coming from not your own personal opinion, not Kathleen Vollmann's opinion, but what's published in peer review literature as to what you can do to solve this. And Todd Brindle did take a lot of those concepts and did put it in the WOC literature, which I was very appreciative of.
So starting with the evidence, using the research to help argue either way, argue with the new, I don't mean argue in a negative way.
No, but discuss.
Discuss. This is what the data say all the way up the line. Then can I help you with it? Is that probably part of your approach?
I presume. Yeah, it was my approach when I spent full time as a clinical nurse specialist. If I had staff that were challenged with this, I'd partner with them and walk them through it to be able to show them that it was safe to do this. And when I talk with audiences around the world, almost every one of them, at least I'd say over 50% of the audience has had a patient cardiac arrest during a bath or when they put the patient on the table at CAT scan. And then I literally walk them back. So remember all the activities you did before CAT scan called. That patient doesn't have any reserve left. And they're, you know, they have this big kind of aha moment of like, oh my gosh, okay, that's why it happened. So understanding that physiology gets you to the why.
So good. It's so good. Last minute thoughts for our audience today, Kathleen?
Work through that fear because you are the patient advocate and harm occurs both ways. And the likelihood that harm will occur by mobilizing what you believe is a hemodynamically unstable patient can be mitigated by using the evidence and using this stepwise process I talked to you about.
Thank you so much. Well, we've heard from the expert in the field that pressure injuries can be prevented in the critically ill, and most of it centers on being aware of the oxygen debt that slowly occurs when you pack on multiple activities, but still move them incrementally and get them able to eventually get out of the bed. Our guest for this session was Kathleen Bowman, an internationally known expert in the care of the critically ill. I want to thank you again, Kathleen, for joining me today. I want to thank you for working with NPIAP because you understand that field so very well. I certainly want to thank Courtney Smith. Courtney will be editing this, so hopefully all of the ums and ahs are edited out before you see it. And of course, I want to thank the University of Nebraska at the College of Nursing for being the host. Thanks much. I'll see you in the next podcast.
Dr. Black, we cannot thank you enough. We say this every time, but we always learn something new from you, and it is always immediately usable in our practice. So thank you to Dr. Black. Thank you so much to the National Pressure Injury Advisory Panel. And thank you to all that helped bring this series into fruition. And thank you to all of you who so loyally listen to our wonderful production of RN Huddle. Thank you so much and take care. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to RN Huddle. To stay connected, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at UNMCCNE or check out unmc.edu/CNE for more program information.